Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, the Black Arts and Culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. We are so excited to have in the studio how do you pronounce your name, Jubilee?
Jubilee.
And she is going to be telling us about the Theater of Eugen's latest work, Emmett Till, A River. And we're also joined by one of the actors. How do you pronounce your first name?
Uis.
Uis Vowles. And he's going to be playing the roles of Mamie Till and Emmett Till. It's really exciting. So perhaps we could start off by just talking about the Theater of Eugen and sort of, you know, tackling this particular topic. Because Theater of Eugen, if anyone knows about Eugen Theater, is a Japanese form. Maybe you could start, I'll just call you Miss Moore right at the moment, so I don't continue to kill your name. Just tell us a little bit about the Theater of Eugen and about Eugen Theater, and then I'll introduce you properly.
Okay. Theater of Eugen has been around. This is our 35th anniversary season, so we've been around for a while. And we kind of focus in on studying traditional Japanese theater forms of no and kyogen. And no in particular is it's a masked lyric drama. And it usually deals as its centerpiece with a figure, from a historical figure who is passed, whose spirit may be in a state of unrest. And we have looked at various plays, various stories over the years, and we've found certain resonance with Western stories that people are already familiar with, and like our audience will already be familiar with, and then they can just enjoy the beautiful treatment that we're able to provide through music and dance and costume and set pieces. And actually, since we're coming up to the holiday season, one of our most successful pieces in the past was a piece called No Christmas Carol. So it was a story that people were familiar with. It was a figure who actually had the central figure, Ebenezer, has interactions with the spirit world, and the audience was readily able to accept that. And then we just performed it in, you know, beautiful stylized costumes and versions and song and dance and such. With this story, with the Emmett Till story, it was kind of brought to us by our then artists in residence, Judy Halepsky and Kevin Simmons. And it was a story that had kind of haunted them both as they were growing up. And I very shamefully was unfamiliar with this story when they brought it to me. And I felt that that was a wrong that needed to be righted in some way. And so it was a story, or it is a story that many people are familiar with. And so we wanted to look at the Emmett Till story, but we wanted an artistic medium that kind of facilitated an exchange so we could talk to the spirits of the dead, so we could hear Emmett Till's voice. So that's how it kind of started. And we were also looking, when we first started the conversation, we were looking at oratorio, which is, it's considered a sacred genre, but it's kind of like an opera, but it's in a concert version. So we wanted to pare down what we typically do at Theater of Eugen and do a fully staged production. We wanted to pare that down and just focus on the story, the text, and the music. And so we've been looking at breaking down the music into various sections that are probably more commonly associated with the oratorio style than maybe with a no style. But when we constructed the script, we were definitely looking at no conventions. So we have an overture, which you wouldn't necessarily have in a no play, but we have a shidai, which you wouldn't necessarily have in an oratorio. So we've kind of merged these two dramatic mediums as we look at this significant story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Does that shed any light?
Yeah, I mean, this is definitely one of those topics where it's great to hear us talk about it, but people really need to be in the studio and witnessing
like
this. Actually, Emmett Till a River by Kevin Simmons and Judy Halepsky is going to have its opening, its premiere, November 7th through 17th, Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays at 8 o'clock, and Sundays at 2 at No Space in Project Arto in San Francisco, 2840 Mariposa Street, San Francisco. And the way it's priced is pretty cool, particularly the programs that are sort of surrounding the production, like Teens for 10 and Opening Night and a talk, which is sounds really interesting, with the person who does sort of like theater and looks at theater and its use in conflict. What's the name of your
Larry Bogard. Larry Bogard will be leading a symposium talk on Thursday, November 14th at 6 p.m. at Mariposa Studio. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, we're very, very excited about that panel. We have some remarkable guests. Basically, we titled it 35 and Counting. So we're kind of looking at art, you know, art matters. You know, there's a very popular intersection that's happening right now with arts and social justice. And that's kind of what we're looking at. And the panelists are Rodessa Jones, Donald Lacey of Love Life Foundation.
Wow, Rodessa Jones of Medea Project Theater for Incarcerated Women.
We're very excited that she was able to jump on board. And then we also were very honored. We have two members from the Mamie Till Foundation. They're coming all the way out from Chicago. Erica Gordon Taylor and Ollie. I'm forgetting Ollie's last name.
What's the what's the foundation that they're in Chicago?
It's the Mamie Till Foundation.
Are you serious?
Totally serious. I know. I know. It's a very big deal for us, and I want everyone to
come. It's a big deal for all of us.
It is. It's a big honor, and they've made it very clear that they don't endorse projects, per se. There's so many different artist renditions and explorations of the Emmett Till story, which is absolutely wonderful. So they really wanted to make a point that they don't necessarily endorse this particular project, but they were very personally interested in seeing it, and that was, of course, very flattering. And so we're trying to, you know, still fund their way to come out here, but they have made a commitment to being here and to being on this panel, this discussion of art and social justice, which I think they probably know a great deal about.
Certainly, certainly. Wow, that is so. All that's happening on November 14th, before the show, pre-show, 6 to 7:30.
Yeah.
Wow, that's going to be and that particular evening pre-show is $15 if you want to have a dinner, a bento dinner, but it's pay what you will. So it's a community invitation, you know, for people to come out and have a conversation. That is awesome. Do you all often do this?
We try to. This one is a, yes, we have done this with various productions, but this one is nice because we're able to have it in a different space, and we're, organizing dinner to really try to make a nice, comfortable conversation. And we have such an amazing panel of guest speakers, so.
Wow.
Feels a little bit more official, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, Louise, Vals, you are here in Northern California by way of Spain, and I don't know how to pronounce the name of the city. How do you pronounce the name of the city where you're from?
Igualada.
Igualada. Where is that?
It's about an hour outside of Barcelona.
Okay. Yeah. So you graduated with a BA in Dramatic Arts from San Francisco State University, and here you are at the No Theater Company, and just wondering sort of how you came to this particular theater and Theater of Yugen, I should say, and these particular roles that you're going to be portraying. Emmett Till is what happened to him, young man who went to Money, Mississippi to visit his relatives. He, you know, was a Chicagoan boy, you know, didn't know anything about the segregated South and never made it home. He was brutally murdered, lynched, and his mother, Mamie Till, didn't let the powers that be cover up this brutal murder and of her young son. I think he's like 14. He was really young,
mm-hmm.
and pursued it until she could bring the perpetrators to justice, because the first trial they actually were all acquitted. So I was wondering, you know, you're gonna be you know, right there in the center of the piece, because you've got the two pivotal characters, the son and the mother. I just wondered if you could talk about, so what brought you to the Theater of Yugen, and what, you know, what resonated for you around wanting to portray these two characters?
Mm-hmm. Well, my travels to get to Theater of Yugen took a little while. Although I was born in Spain, I moved to the U.S. Fairly young, and grew up on the East Coast, both in New Jersey and Miami. But I'd always been drawn to the Japanese aesthetic, I suppose, and had studied some Buddhism as well as martial arts. And when I came out to San Francisco to finish my degree, I just fell into, with Yukihiro Goto, Suzuki training, and some dabbling in No and Kyogen. And that's how I met the founder of Theater of Yugen, Yuriko Doi, who is an amazing woman and had set up this company to explore that intersect between medieval Japanese theater, in a way, and the contemporary theater. So one of the things I really enjoy about No and Kyogen is that it is medieval and very ancient tradition, but it's very contemporary in certain ways as well, in that it does break down some of the barriers, I think, between the audience and the actors. So we, I joined Theater of Yugen in 1993, so it's been a while now, 20 years, and one of the things I like about No Theater is that the actor, there's no pretense that the actor is, you know, to a degree trying to pretend to be someone else. They generally wear a mask, and so you'll have very often like old men playing, you know, very young women, and they'll just use their own voice, but they'll still create that inner life, that feeling, that fundamental grief or joy that is warranted at the time. And so in approaching Mamie Till, it resonates very, very strongly with a number of plays in the No canon, specifically Fujito and Sumidagawa, which are probably the two most famous ones. And they both basically involve a woman who has lost her child in a very tragic way that was very unjustified. And so dealing with that universal loss of something so tragic that we should all be able to sympathize with. And I think that's one of the reasons why what Mamie Till did was so important is that she did put this story, made sure that this story was told, because people needed to see it and realize, you know, what was really going on, and trying to imagine yourself in other people's shoes is the first step in terms of undoing a lot of these unjust practices, I guess, that we've had through the years. So my basic approach is to, especially with Mamie Till, to focus on the on this grief of unjustified loss of your child, which thankfully I have not personally experienced, but is universal in terms of cultures. I think everyone's got some kind of story that's similar in some way that will resonate.
Yeah, I was just thinking. So as you're dancing, is the chorus singing and then the musician is playing? How to sort of describe a scene? And do you have a favorite scene or a scene that's harder than others to go to get through or to develop?
Well, normally in a no play, this is an oratorio, so there is actually no dancing, which I kind of miss. So it's been challenging in a certain way because it really does make the music front and center, and Kevin Simmons' score is just really gorgeous. Very difficult to sing, but when you feel like you've hit what he wants, it's amazingly rewarding. It is a very difficult script, and one of the things about Noam Kilgan is since it's very very refined in a way, and comes from a time when you didn't have like any special effects or lights or microphones, there's a lot of energy that has to be put out by the actors and the musicians and the chorus members to make sure that like every moment on stage is really really full and engaged. So it's a very exhausting form, and this piece is there's not a moment that I think is really easy. So I'm not there's maybe songs that I enjoy singing a little bit more, but at all times, it's very very engaging for me to try and get through it. There's a couple of moments where Kevin sort of tries to, at least in my opinion, I mean, I can't speak for him, but it seems like he's trying to interweave a little bit of the gospel tradition in with his conception of No, and that's I think those for me, when we work with these new projects in Theater of Hugin, that's one of the more exciting parts, is the weaving of different musical traditions, because I think it's one of the most accessible ways of transferring culture is through music, because we get away from the words, which can kind of get in the way, especially if you don't understand the language. But music, as they say, is universal. So
mm-hmm. Yeah. So you and Ms. Moore, you go back 20 years. You're the director, graduate of Bard College, and you are the artistic director of Theater of Hugin, and have been with the company and a student of Yuriko Doi since 1993. And you act, direct, and write for the theater, and you have devoted your professional life to exploring the ongoing life of traditional Japanese contemporary American theater. And recently you've been honored with the Anna Edelman Prize, as well as the Carter Tobin Prize for performance and your production of Purgatory, which won the award for Best Ensemble at the 2001 Lunacy Festival. No, not Lunacy. Lunae. Yeah. And in addition, where is that at? Where is the Lunae Festival at?
You know, it moves around the state. So that year, I think we did it in Sacramento. So it happens all around.
Okay, where was it this year, and or where is it next year?
That's a good question. I don't know, actually. It's not on my calendar, so I don't know. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, when you find it, let me know. I've never heard of it. That sounds great.
Okay. I'll make a note.
In addition to being a Japan Foundation Fellow, you have recently been the fortunate recipient of the Theater Bay Area's Cash Fund, and you're among the first recipients of Theater Communications Group's New Leadership U program. And I was wondering if you briefly could talk about some of the collaborators, because I noticed that Kevin Simmons, the lead writer and composer, he's a poet and composer originally from New Orleans, and I'm from New Orleans. And and I wanted to mention to you, Luis, that I was in the studio. I mean, I was in the theater when you performed as Garcia Lorca in the Blood Wine Blood Wedding. That was really phenomenal at Fort Mason Center. Yeah, that was really, really nice. I think I've come to maybe two or three of your plays in your illustrious canon, but always really, really enjoy the work. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the collaborators and additional cast members. Luis, you could jump in too if you like.
Well, I think I'll go ahead and begin because I'm very, very honored to be working with the artists involved in this collaboration. I'd like to, I guess, first mention the chorus. They're just beautiful, beautiful young men. We're working with Dario Slavaza and Khalil Sullivan and Derek Lasseter, and they're all remarkable musicians and singers and artists in their own right, and they have a beautiful sound together. From their first rehearsal, they've been able to sound as one voice, and it's just beautiful. So they're worth coming just for them. But wait, there's more. I'm always honored to work with the designers on this that we have that are artistic associates of the company. So Josh McDermott is doing the sets, as well as Steven Siegel is doing the lights. And I'm very excited to see what they've cooked up for this is a very unusual piece for us. As Luis mentioned, we're not dancing. We're giving our attention and our focus to the music and to the script, but we still have to try to create an environment in which that can take place, and I'm excited to share that. I think it's going to be lovely. And I'm hugely, hugely honored to be working with a gentleman named David Crandall, who in many ways is actually a teacher for me. And it's always a bit nerve-wracking to invite your teacher to work with you on a production because you feel that your faults are always laid bare before them. But he's being a complete angel. He's come to us via Japan, Seattle, and he's currently living in Michigan. So he's out here for just this rehearsal period and performance run. And he brings a depth and a wealth of knowledge of no to the project that just, there isn't anyone here in the Bay Area who could do that. So he's actually playing the no-con flute, the Kotozumi drum, which is a small shoulder drum. And he's also playing something which actually is only generally used for training purposes called the Hyoshiban, which is basically just a big block of wood. But through those three instruments, he's able to give a full array of the, the no orchestra, the feel and the power of that orchestra he's able to do as a one-man band. which is very non-traditional, but his openness to Kevin's composition and to experimentation has just been such a blessing.
He's a very good drummer, and we can tell because he has a very good voice.
Yeah.
He has these kakegoe, which are these drum calls that you make in between your drum hits, and they're almost more important than the hits themselves, they say. And he just has a beautiful resonance to give you that flavor of what's going on in the moment.
Yeah, I was just looking at something that the co-writer, Judy Halapsky, wrote in describing the project in its evolution, and she says, as a poet and Japanese literature scholar, I see No as a particularly appropriate form to address the brutal murder of young Emmett Till. In No, the dead can speak to the living and resolve lingering issues of their tragic deaths. Our production honors Till's memory and evokes a contained rage. While addressing a historic event, this work asks us to examine the current inequalities in our society and individual lives. In keeping with the tradition of No, we draw on audience knowledge of U.S. history to create a work that is not explicit, but delicately suggestive and poetically evocative. Oh, and also I wanted to mention that on Friday performances, you're going to have a discussion and Q&A led by Judy with the artist. That should be really wonderful as well. But I don't know, it just seems like the writing is just going to be so rich and dense. And I'm glad you're having all these opportunities for people to talk, because it seems as if people are going to really be moved and need a place to be able to unpack all of this, that you're going to be sort of, not as instigating necessarily, but pulling up for people in this experience, this real intense experience.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, we're calling it a No meditation. And you know, that can be the actual piece itself, but it also could be what happens after the piece has concluded. And it's a very timely, unfortunately, a very timely and resonant subject to be delving into right now. And so it's nice to have an opportunity to, or I guess, to have an expression, an artful expression, to just come together, to be in a room together, and to just listen. Something that I've been thinking about with this project is that No, in many ways, is pacifist theater. You usually, you know, there's a whole category of No plays that are referred to as warrior No plays, but they are from the loser's perspective most of the time, so from the fallen figure. And when you hear about war or any conflict from that side, you really get a different picture than maybe we're most accustomed to. So it's a time to reflect, to be contemplative. Having just experienced Halloween last night, I feel like we're entering that time of year when this is very appropriate to be thinking about those that have gone before us, our ancestors, and learning from them as much as we can.
Yeah, it's the perfect, sort of time in the season and in the year. You know, the fall, winter's coming, and sort of, you know, remembering our ancestors, you know, formerly in, you know, Dia de los Muertos and the Maafa commemoration and things like that. And also, you know, recently, as in this week, there was a youngster killed shot by police in Solano County. I think he was he 13? He was a really young child.
Very young.
Yeah. And so here's another mother, you know, a family that has lost their child to tragic violence. So this you know, this play and this topic and Emmett Till's life, as you mentioned, Luis, that you haven't, you know, we might not have personally experienced this, but as a collective consciousness, you know, as a nation and as a people, you know, too many of our children are disappearing from us, literally, through violence, whether that's police violence or violence within the community, intra-communal violence or family violence, or even maybe they're not physically killed, but, you know, they're shut down, you know, by educational systems that don't necessarily speak to their souls in a way that can enliven them and make them want to be inquisitive and creative and things like that. So, yeah, this is going to be really heavy duty for your 35th anniversary production.
We're kicking it off.
You certainly are. Yeah, yeah. You keep on outdoing yourselves as a company.
Thank you. We're trying. We're definitely trying.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. Well, I want to thank you both so much for joining us today to talk about, you know, this wonderful program. And do you want to give the details again?
Yes. It's taking, so Emmett Till A River opens on Thursday, November 7th. It runs Thursday, Friday, Saturdays at 8, Sundays at 2. We're running through the 17th of November. And we would love to do a ticket giveaway. I actually just realized we wanted to do that. I don't know if that's something that can happen. Somebody wants to call in, I guess.
Oh, that'd be lovely. Sure.
And encourage some people to come. And we do have, you know, visit our website, theatervegan.org. We're doing a teens for $10 on Sunday, November 10th. We have audience talkbacks with the artists on Friday evenings, the 8th and the 15th. And we have a special 35 and counting symposium on Thursday, November 14th at 6 p.m. in Mariposa Studio.
Yeah.
So a lot is going on.
Yeah, certainly, certainly. And for the ticket giveaway, which evening or which afternoon?
I would love for them to come to our opening. We're going to kick off our opening with a champagne toast. So we would love if they could join us on November 7th.
Okay, all right, excellent. So, super. Well, if anyone is interested, you can like us on our page on Facebook, or you can send me a blog post here at the radio show, and I will include your contact information so I can get back to you. And
that's
I will
wonderful.
Let you all
Thank
know
you.
Who that lucky person is.
Awesome. Great. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you so much for joining us, both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Sure. You
yes,
take good care.
You.
Looking forward to seeing you
right.
in the theater.
Great.
Bye-bye.
Yes. Take care.
Bye. So I wanted to mention to our audience that you means deep, quiet, otherworldly, and Jen means subtle, profound, and dark. So Theater of Yukon is going to be really wonderful. So we are joined in the studio by the director of the American Indian Film Festival. Good morning, Mike. How are you?
Good morning, Wanda. Very good. Thank you.
Wow, you are so busy. Today is the day that you're kicking it off, right?
Yes. Yes, it's really going to be a great day today. It's the 38th Annual American Indian Film Festival, produced by our organization, the American Indian Film Institute, here in San Francisco.
Right, right, yeah. And so from tonight, Friday, November 1st, through Saturday, November 9th, people are going to be able to watch these wonderful films at the Delancey Street Theater, 600 Embarcadero Boulevard in San Francisco. And then you're having an awards, American Indian Motion Picture Awards show on Sunday, November 10th at the San Francisco Jazz Center, and that's going to be really exciting. So why don't you tell us a little bit about this annual institution, and I think it might be unique to our country, right? There aren't that many American Indian Film Festivals happening throughout the country, are there?
Yeah, we're the oldest festival dedicated to American Indian and Canada First Nation communities. We been presenting for going nearly four decades now. We've been presenting a lot of documentaries, short narrative films, features. So it's been quite a ride for us here as the organizing group, and bringing together a lot of really educational films that are open to, the festival, of course, is open to all audiences, and we encourage all people to come and learn a little bit more about American Indian and Canada, Native peoples. You know, we've, this year especially, you know, we have over 80 films that we're going to be presenting during this 9 days, which also includes a number of youth films that will be presented a week from today at the Delancey Street Theater in the morning. Our organization has an annual, has a program that has been running for 12 years now. It's called the Tribal Touring Program, and it's an opportunity for Indian communities to learn, especially their young people, to learn media skills. We bring a team of filmmakers to different reservations and rancherias to work with approximately 25 to 30 young people. And they get a crash course in scripting and production shoot, learning about cameras, sound, and lighting. And they put together short films that are made in the communities. They're approximately 5 minutes in length, 5 to 10 minutes in length, that are made during a period in the summer. And they are premiered locally at the tribal community. And they're also shown here in our film festival in November. So we have a lot of young people that are learning valuable media skills. And you know, we say media because we're, you know, we're not only encouraging our young people to learn production skills, but also to think about broader areas in media. You know, American Indians are, you know, underrepresented in media. You know, we're still trying to catch up. You know, we have a lot of opportunities for young people that are really opening in the last several years. And I wanted to, you know, commend the NAACP for their efforts in really opening a lot of doors in broadcast industry. And I think those doors have opened a lot for American Indians and other minority people. So it's important that our young people have the skills available and the initiatives and the heart to really think about media, think about change, and go through some of these doors. So we have the Tribal Touring Program. We have a number of short films from our organization. We have some Canadian youth media programs and also going to be part of that special morning program, November 8th at the Delancey. So there's a lot going on, you know, during not only the films, a lot of our actors and filmmakers will be in attendance. We have a special event next week also with the Tribal Touring Program. Right after that, there's going to be a special workshop conducted by one of the VPs of casting for CBS, Fern Orenstein, who's one of the lead casting directors for CBS. It's a lot of their network series that they do at CBS. She'll be working with presenting a workshop that will be talking about how best to come into audition. And, you know, we have a lot of young people that are interested in acting, and I think Fern will really do a super job in making that her skills are best to show their skills to CBS.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So do you go back 38 years with the film festival and with the organization that puts it on?
Yes, I was... the first festival that was held was up in Seattle, Washington. I was a student at the University of Washington. We had I was working with an Indian organization also called United Indians of All Tribes Foundation. And part of my job was working with different parts of our Seattle community in kind of identifying special needs that they wanted to pursue, mostly in cultural arts, dancing and singing and a lot of the crafts type of things. And one of them, one of the days we were talking about what activities they wanted to do, and it was suggested that we maybe look at maybe media of some type of an event. And we came up with the plans for maybe an American Indian Film Fest. And so from those early discussions and kind of said, well, where are the films? You know, so it was my job to really identify what was out there in 1975. And we found about 18 films that were very kind of positive in portrayals of Indian people, and packaged those all together and presented the first festival back in the spring of 1975 at the University of Washington. And then, you know, from there, you know, the festival, myself moving to the California, the Bay Area, kind of resurrected the festival with the American Indian Center in San Francisco. And we had programs in 1977, 78, National Congress of American Indians in 1979, hosted and sponsored the festival. In late in 79, the American Indian Film Institute was incorporated and therefore became the legal house for, you know, for sponsoring the festival and fundraising and all that. So it's been a long history, you know, of Indian people being involved in producing this event. And, you know, it's an important that as kind of a vehicle for American Indians to get our messages across, that, you know, it'd be produced by American Indians, because it's who best to really kind of know, you know, what the realities are of being Indian in today's world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Are you a director? You mentioned that you were a student, you know, in Pacific Northwest. Were you studying directing, or are you a filmmaker yourself, or an artist of another genre?
I am not. I was studying American history at the University of Washington, but, you know, the work I've done all my young adult and adult life has been around film and music production. I'm mostly, I consider myself as a promoter of our talents. And, you know, with we have so many talented Indian people that are making movies and writing and directing, and a lot of our performing artists, you know, that I'm able to really kind of grasp both of those worlds, you know, the film and the performing arts, you know, with our festival, you know, by putting all these packages together with the festival and our award show, which recognizes outstanding talent, film talent. And we have a big show coming up on Sunday, November 10, mm-hmm. at the San Francisco Jazz Center, which is our annual American Indian Motion Picture Awards show. So we'll be presenting a number of awards in Best Film, Director, Actor, Music Video, Documentary Short and Feature, Public Service Awards. So it's going to be a nice show. We have a lot of outstanding Indian talent that will be performing. We have some Pomo dancers that will be performing in the opening part of the show. It's about a nearly four-hour show that will be produced at the Jazz Center, starting at 4 p.m. and running till about 8 o'clock. So we're all looking forward to that. It's a good opportunity for the public to see our performing artists, you know, because a lot of them still find it difficult to find venues to perform at. And we hope through the festival and the award show that a lot of them may have some more opportunities to go out to different venues and make their living. You know, fortunately, a lot of our tribal communities have, you know, with the casinos, they all have entertainment venues, and, you know, a lot of them do perform at the different casinos across the country, and the festival has a very significant part of our support is through a lot of tribes that do have casinos, so it's really a good opportunity for tribes to show their support of Indian films and our performing artists. So it's really a good mix of film, support from our own people. But we do also, you know, fundraising, and I do want to really not only thank our top sponsor, the Jackson Rancheria here in California, but also like the San Francisco Foundation for their support, grants for the arts in San Francisco, and Siquan, the Seminole Tribe of Florida. So we do have a lot of tribes across the country that support the American Indian Film Festival, and you know, we're always looking for ways to support our young people and our filmmakers and actors, and this is a really a national venue for that support.
Yeah. Well, why don't we let our audience know some of the talent that's going to be performing at the awards night, as well as maybe talk about some of the films, and also you're having a spotlight on Stephen Paul Judd. You might want to talk about that, too, just sort of give our audience a taste of sort of, and also there are some filmmakers that actually live here in the San Francisco Bay Area whose work is going to be premiering, and you've got some like episodes of you know television shows that are going to be premiered or shown as well. So there's quite a variety of programming. So maybe we could talk a little bit about some of the artists and some of the films. Maybe you could talk about some of the films, particularly, you know, opening night film, and then you're going to be, showing a special presentation of Star Wars Episode 4, A New Hope, in Navajo language. Talk about some of these special programs and filmmakers and artists.
Okay, well, I wanted to start off with maybe our Stephen Paul Judd. He is a Kiowa artist out of Oklahoma who we're starting to hear about as an emerging filmmaker the last several years. And, we got to know Stephen a couple of years ago. Films that he had made, a short film called In Search of the World's Best Indian Taco, which was a 12-minute short that won our best short film. And also during that same year, he directed a music video that spotlighted a couple of young Seminole Indian performers out of Florida. So those are two of his entries 2 years ago, or 3 years ago. And so we got to know Stephen, and we asked him to take part as one of our mentors in the tribal touring program that we do every summer. And from there, discussions went on, you know, with his art, and we're talking about maybe looking at some of his art to produce as our poster. So we're talking with him and said, you know, it'd be nice if you would, come up with something that would be representative of our Indian film industry, and we can produce it as a poster. So he came up with really a nice imagery for this year's event. He calls it Red Carpet. And we have a number of our prominent actors on that poster, including the late Will Sampson, who was the Indian in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. But Will did so much more than Cuckoo's Nest, but he's most known for the Cuckoo's Nest film. And Will Sampson was one of our founding directors for the American Indian Film Institute back in 79. Mm-hmm. Also included on that poster is Wes Studi, who is prominently known for Dances with Wolves and Last of the Mohicans, some of current films like Heat, which was, I think it was Al Pacino, was one of the lead actor in that. But West Studi, Jay Silverheels, who was actually the original Tonto on the television and the movie serials that were back in the 50s and 60s. Also, Gary Farmer and Graham Greene, who is one of our most prominent actors today. Graham was nominated for Best Supporting Actor for Dances with Wolves from the Academy, the Oscars, so he is on that poster. Graham Greene is also featured in our opening night film, Chasing Shakespeare, with Danny Glover, starring Danny Glover and Tantu Cardinal. That's our opening film tonight. One of the producers, and also Tracy Rickards, who's one of the co-stars of the film, will be representing Chasing Shakespeare this evening. We also have a film called Sky and Chang, which is kind of an action film that was actually a pilot for a TV series with the Aboriginal People's Television Network up in Canada. APTN is a national network. It's supported by public monies. It's broadcast on their cable system up in Canada, but they do produce a lot of content for the Canadian audiences, and it's really something that when I really think about Canada and the number of television shows that they have, you know, dealing with American Indian people today in a contemporary context, it's really surpasses what we have here in the U.S. A lot of times, with our festival just kind of bringing the spotlight on what's happening with current American Indian and Canadian films, we don't really see anything on television. You know, we don't really have a regular Indian character on television in any episodic television series. So people tend to think of Indian people in the past. So, and it's almost the reverse in Canada with their major network is the CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. They do have APTN, the Aboriginal People's TV Network, that, you know, really creates TV series, and a lot of programming is offered 7 days a week. They also, on the CBC, the national network, they have a televised Indian awards show that recognizing a lot of varied individuals and varied professional skills. And this is what we are striving for with the American Indian Motion Picture Awards show. You know, we've been producing that show since 78. And for a long time, it was just a small part of the festival, but an important part. It was generally on our last day of the festival, and we would present our awards, which would probably last about maybe an hour. We would be able to present the awards back in 2000. It was like the year 2000. We started looking at the award show as a show and looking at expanding it, increasing the talent. So it's grown to that 3.5-4 hour award show that it is today. But our next really big goal is to try to get this show televised. And we're looking at really increasing the visibility of Indian P televised award show. And I think by moving to the San Francisco Jazz Center, it really lends itself to television. We had been at the Palace of Fine Arts presenting parts of our film program and our award show since 1977. So this is our first year away from the Palace of Fine Arts, and we're looking at this as an opportunity to open a new door and create some more visibility for our artists. So the award show is an important part, and I think with the award show on television, that's going to even increase visibility for the films that we show, the artists that we present, and the performing artists especially, to hopefully open some doors for them. So the festival is that type of an opportunity for our people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so are you saying that it is going to be televised this year?
No, we are actually doing a streaming, a live stream of the award show this year.
Mm-hmm.
And so that will be available on our website. And we're pretty easy to find. It's it's AIFISF.com, American Indian Film Institute.com. So, you know, we're going to be doing that this year, but we're hoping to really look at some regional televised opportunities. I'm looking at some areas around the country, such as especially here, San Francisco Bay Area, but Southern California, San Diego, the Northwest up in Seattle, Phoenix, Minneapolis, Fort Lauderdale, Hollywood, and up in the Northeast, in Connecticut and New York. So we're kind of looking at some regional opportunities, possibly going with an independent station and maybe utilizing the different sponsor opportunities in these regions, especially with some of the casinos. We have casinos across the country, and a lot of the tribes, you know, buy advertising on television, especially here in the Bay Area. You see a lot of print and radio and television ads with a lot of the casinos purchasing advertising. So we're hoping that they can take those dollars and help us get our regional shows together across the country. But like I said, you know, it's visibility, and that's what we're in search of. And I think the opportunity for the filmmakers and actors and performing artists to participate will really increase with broadcast showings of the award show.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. And all of the screenings are going to be happening at the Delancey Street Theater, November 1st through 9th, and 600 Embarcadero Boulevard in San Francisco. And then there are also evening screenings. And I was wondering, the programs with, you know, the panelists and the workshops for the young people, is that all going to be happening at Delancey Street as well?
All of our events are at Delancey Street.
Okay.
We have a distribution panel that will bring a number of filmmakers, and we have California Lawyers for the Arts participating on that panel as a co-sponsor of the panel. And Andrew Smith is one of our filmmakers. And I think it's an opportunity for our filmmakers to talk about how they're getting their films out and what obstacles they're facing. And hopefully, you know, through this networking, we can come up with some solutions to really solidify a strategy to really say, we have these Indian films, and, you know, they're basically just going to film festivals. You know, how can we get them out to bigger audiences? So that's really one of the challenges that we have as minority programmers, is not only American Indian, but other communities face similar obstacles. And, you know, so we're hoping that to increase the number of people to see these films, but also through this workshop, it's really open. We encourage people to come out, filmmakers or from other communities that have issues that, you know, maybe some of the things that we're going through as Indian filmmakers, they'll see within their own community and their own vision of how they're trying to get their films out also. So the panel is scheduled for 12 noon next Thursday, the 7th of November. It'll be running for about 2 hours. So a lot of things, and that is free. That's a free event. The program with the youth program on Friday, November 8th, a week from today, is also a free event. So encourage a lot of young people to come. We do have a lot of schools that come, different classes, but the content is still teenage content. So, you know, we really encourage, like, if any teachers are interested in coming, you know, that they realize that. And generally it's about 14, 15-year-old audience, you know, if any classes are coming. We did have a couple, probably about 5 or 6 years ago, we had a class that brought some first graders in, and I think a lot of times it didn't really look at the content, and really it was too small of a youth offering to really realize the content. So we do recommend, you know, high school age kids, if they're interested in coming to the Tribal Touring program. It's a free program next Friday, November 8th.
What time?
It starts at 10 o'clock in the morning.
Okay.
And it'll run for about 2 hours, and
okay,
then we'll follow that with the CBS casting workshop, and that'll begin at 2 o'clock.
Okay, cool. Well, we are out of time, and I wanted to, if you could let our audience know how they can get tickets. The tickets are matinee screenings are $7, and evening screenings are $9, and closing night screening is $20, and the opening night screening tonight is $20. And the American Indian Motion Picture Awards Show, which is Sunday, November 10th, is $20 in advance, $25 at the door. And then there's a VIP post-awards party Sunday, November 10th, and that's $50. And then all access, it's a $222 value, but it's at a discount, $160. And it includes access to all American Indian Film Festival 38 screenings, panels, VIP post-award party, and award show. That sounds like a real good bargain. So how do people get tickets?
They can go to our website to actually look at the whole complete schedule, all of the activities and films and special events. Again, that's just, you can go to American Indian Film Festival. Might be the fastest way to get to it. But it's our website is AIFISF.com. Take a look at that. We do have advanced available that they can purchase. I think it's brown paper bag that has doing our advanced tickets, so they can purchase those tickets through them and come to the festival. Tonight, again, we're starting at 7 p.m., but with the ticket, there is a reception at 6 o'clock p.m. So the 6 p.m. reception, actually two films this evening. So we thank you for this opportunity and encourage the public to check out the website and support American Indian Canada First Nation.
Congratulations on 38 years, and looking forward to continuing our conversation at future times so we can support your wonderful organization over the year, not just at the premiere you know, performances and film festival, because I know you're working all throughout the year doing some really wonderful work. Okay. We are joined in the studio by Peter Callender. It's been a long time. Good morning.
Good morning, Wanda. How are you?
I'm fine. I don't even know if I've seen you this year, and it's at the end of it.
Have you not? I've done, this is a... Driving Miss Daisy, what we'll talk about, is the fourth or fifth production I've done this year?
Yeah, no, I haven't seen you this year at all.
Oh, my goodness. Well, that makes me sad.
Yeah, it makes me sad, too, so I'm so happy that you remembered me. It's like, I hope he remembers me.
Of course.
When I put in the request, like, oh, I hope he remembers me and joins us to talk about Driving Miss Daisy, like, wow, that is a classic.
It is a wonderful classic. I'm hearing a little clicking in the phone. Do you hear that as well? There's a little clicking. I hope that's not disturbing our conversation.
I hear an echo, but I can hear you pretty clearly, so we'll just
wonderful.
Talk through it.
Okay, that's good. That's good.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Driving Miss Daisy, our first show of our season, of our 19th season. Very excited about it.
19 years, huh? Wow, that's amazing.
19 years of African American Shakespeare Company in San Francisco, and the company is getting so much more recognition and wonderful reviews, and ticket sales are getting better, and it's just wonderful. People are finding out about African American Shakespeare Company, so we are moving on up. It's wonderful.
Yeah, certainly.
So Driving with Daisy.
Yeah. It opens tomorrow, actually, November 2nd.
We open tomorrow. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and continue through Sunday, November
17th.
And yeah. So tell us about Driving Miss Daisy, this play, and why African-American Shakespeare decided to take it on.
Well, the thing about it is, it's I did this production with the same cast 3.5 years ago, almost 4 years ago, at the Diablo Actors Ensemble in Walnut Creek. It was sold out every single night. It was a small theater, much smaller than the Burial Clay, where African American Shakespeare is in San Francisco. But it was sold out every night in Walnut Creek at the Diablo Actors Ensemble, and it won all kinds of awards. The production won. I won a San Francisco Bay Area Critics Circle Award. The actress playing Daisy also won the award. The actor playing Bully was nominated for the award. So it's an award-winning production that we're bringing to San Francisco. And we had so much fun with it out there, and we thought that it's never been in the Bay Area. We wanted to bring it to African American Shakespeare Company. We wanted to get the rights for it. We got it. There was supposed to be, I'll give you a little bit of a backstory here, there was supposed to be a tour with James Earl Jones coming through, but that never happened. So we were able to get the rights, and we're the only theater company in the region with the rights to Driving Miss Daisy. So we got it, and we have a lovely, lovely production opening tomorrow with Anne Kendrick as Daisy and Timothy Bagley as Bully, and I play Hoke. It's a wonderful story. As you know, Morgan Freeman made it a wonderful film with Jessica Chandy. James Earl Jones was on Broadway. So it is a delightful story. And I really look forward to bringing it to the Bay Area. The story, very briefly, is about Daisy Worthen, who is at the beginning of the show, she's 72. At the end of the show, she's 91. So it takes a 25-year span from the beginning of the program to the end of the show. She's a wealthy Jewish white woman living in Atlanta, widowed. She's having trouble driving. She's getting older. She's having trouble driving. She's crashed a couple of cars. Her son, Bully, is very concerned about her health and welfare and decided to hire a chauffeur for her. That's where Hoke comes in. Initially, Daisy is resistant to this. And over the 25-year span of the show, they become friends and very close friends, but it takes a while for them to warm up to each other. There are only three characters in the play. The play is 85 minutes long, so it's a one act. And it just takes you through this wonderful friendship, this friendship that goes from distrust to absolute friendship. In racist America, Daisy finds out that she's also, being a Jewish woman, she's also discriminated against. I'll save that for the audiences to see what happens. And they both realize that their lives are parallel in many ways, and they become very, very close friends. I love the play. I love the character Hoke. I love doing this play. It's 17 short scenes in 85 minutes. I think the audiences will really love it.
Yeah, I remember I saw it at ACT a while back. It was on Easter Sunday. And then I enjoyed it so much. I read the play, and then I saw the film, and it was really interesting. Spike Lee's discussion of the play at that particular time, you know, wondering why this particular story, and I was wondering. I'm thinking about Lee Daniels, the butler, and your character Hoke. He is not. Mm-hmm. You know, like the character, the butler, he's like, as the butler, I don't know if people know that story, but it's the story depicts, I don't remember the man's real name, but the butler, and he served, I don't know, like a whole lot of presidents. And through the story, he evolves and becomes more conscious of what's going on in America because he's from the Jim Crow South, and he sees his father killed brutally, his mother raped, and that terror, you know, that trauma stays with him when he moves to Washington, and he's just sort of locked in. I'm not gonna make any waves, you know. I'm working for these, you know, at the White House. And meanwhile, he has a son who is a man, a kid, a young man, and then eventually an older person, an adult of the period. And he sees what's going on, and he sees how America needs to change. And I see Hope as like the father, the butler, when he evolves.
That's
I think
correct.
Hope
yeah.
is already there because he is. He is such a man. He's such a refined, dignified man. I just love that character.
Exactly. I think you're
right. Yeah.
You hit it right on the head. He is very dignified. By the way, the character is Eugene Allen, the butler. Played by Forrest Whitaker. I love that. I love the story. He served at, I think it was like 34 years. As a White House butler, so it was a long time. Lots of presidents, but yes, Hoke is very, very refined, very dignified. He's been looking for a job. He gets into the audience actually sees the interview process that he goes through, and he brings to Daisy the things that he's learned over the years, a little bit of patience, humor, dignity, style, grace. And they teach each other those things over the years because he really does want to do well with her. He has served as a chauffeur for some dignitaries in the Atlanta area. He was a chauffeur for a judge. He worked for another family. So he's well trusted and well known and well appreciated. But he does need this job. And when he finally meets Daisy, and he sees what her life is, and Miss Daisy is in a panic in a sense. She's alone. Yes, her son takes care of her, but her son has her own life, his own life, and Daisy doesn't really like her son's family very much. Son's wife. Florine is her son's wife, and although Jewish, she just celebrates Christmas. She has Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer things on her front lawn, and Daisy's like, "What? You know, this is a Jewish family. Why are they celebrating Christmas? She's a little biting at the very beginning, and Hoke, with Hoke's influence, she softens, and she gets more rounded, and she gets calmer, and she realizes that her feelings of prejudice and there's no place for it in the world as it is at the time, and they learn to grow together and they learn to keep each other calm and it's very sweet, and they end up holding hands at the very end. It's very sweet. It's a very sweet story.
And you, Peter Callender, are a native of Trinidad, West Indies, and you've worked professionally as an actor for over 30 years and more recently as director and writer. You received your formal training in the theater
at the Juilliard School.
School in New York City and the Webber Douglas Academy in London, England.
Right.
And mask technique with Julie Taymor, et cetera, et cetera. People can read about the program.
It's been a wonderful career thus far. Yeah. That's just all from the program. But I've been in the Bay Area for over 20 years. I came out here in 1991 to work at Berkeley Repertory Theater, thinking I'd be out here for just a couple of shows maybe. I'd been on Broadway and off-Broadway, and I thought maybe, this is 91, August of 91, and I came out here to do one show, and I've been out here ever since. Associate artist at California Shakespeare Theater for going on 19 years now, and I worked in all the major theaters in the Bay Area from San Jose to Sacramento, and now the artistic director of African American Shakespeare Company, very proudly so, and putting together a wonderful season for the Bay Area.
yeah. I was just thinking about this whole thing about, you know, black men driving. You know, mm-hmm. you directed Lorraine Hansberry's Raisin in the Sun, and in that particular mm-hmm. play, there is, you know, a character.
That's right.
Who's
Walter
driving.
Lee.
Yeah, Walter Lee. Mm-hmm. And then we've mm-hmm. got Richard Wright's native son, and Bigger Thomas is mm-hmm. a chauffeur. So what is this mm-hmm. thing around driving? It's a metaphor.
You know, that's a good question. I don't know if I can answer that. I don't know what the metaphor specifically is. That's a very good question. I hadn't thought of that. I think we need the job, basically. No, I'm not sure, Wanda. as far as Walter Lee, I mean, Walter Lee always wants to be moving forward. Maybe this is a good response to that question. Walter Lee always wants his life moving forward. He wanted his life moving forward for his family. He wanted to be in a better place. He wants to be. He wants to meet people. He wants to be a mover and shaker. He wants to build and grow. And I think for Walter Lee, being in one place, Walter Lee couldn't stay in one place very long. He's like a shark. He's got to keep moving. And I think for Walter Lee, being a chauffeur, I think that metaphor. I think what Lorraine Hansberry may have touched on with that, or desired to touch on with that, was the fact that he had to keep moving. He had to keep moving to stay alive. I think being a chauffeur is that, or chauffeur, I got to keep remember the accent is on the first syllable, to keep himself moving, to keep himself alive. For Hulk, it's a job. It's a job that he loves. It's a job that, you know, he takes absolute care of himself. He's also a widower. His wife has passed. His daughter is married and left the home. He's got grandchildren whom he loves. So he's alone as well as Daisy is. And you know, there's a line in the play where he talks about the state home. When Daisy is getting a little older, and he says, "Let me, you know, I'll show you. I can show you. I can show you what life is like at the state home, and the people hanging around in the hall down there." So he's seen it. You know, perhaps his daughter at one time suggested he take a look at it or something. That's the last place in the world he wants to be. So he wants to keep his life going as long as possible, and he drove Miss Daisy for into his 70s, late 70s. So it you know, he kept it up for a very long time until he absolutely couldn't do it anymore. His eyes were becoming bad. His motion, his reflexes were becoming bad. So I think that's a metaphor for keep moving in life, keep going from place to place. Don't stop. Keep the engine running. Keep the engine. You know, I think all those metaphors can come into play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I certainly agree. I was just thinking about a friend of mine who, Robert King, who was in solitary confinement for 29 years, and he's been he's a member of the Angola 3, and one of the members, Herman Wallace, just passed after being released. I think he was like 42 years in solitary confinement. But anyway, he talks about how, and Geronimo DiGiacca, who is also no longer with us, affirmed this, that driving, he said he felt really free driving.
Mm-hmm,
I mean,
mm-hmm,
something about
mm-hmm.
having an open road in front of you and being behind the wheel and in control, you know, like your person is enlarged, you know, with the vehicle. And just moving, you know, through space and time, even. Yeah, he said he never felt so free. And
mm-hmm.
and certainly, you know, I heard you saying that as well. And we think about these men. We think about the period that Hulk is, you know, is driving Miss Daisy.
Living
in. And
mm-hmm.
that's a period where black men are not free. You know, they're looked at as sus.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's
so
right. I mean, there's a scene in the play where Daisy accuses him of stealing. She does not trust. She does not trust black people. She does not. There are few people actually that Daisy trusts, but she does not trust black people. She is absolutely insisting that her son do not bring this person in, although she has Idella, and Idella in the movie played by Esther Rolle, the late Esther Rolle. She has Idella in the house, and she says, well, she and Idella get along very well. They stay out of each other's way, and she trusts Idella. Whereas having a black male in her house, she feels very very uncomfortable with that, and she doesn't. She keeps him at arm's distance for a very long time. And a few weeks into the hiring of Hope, she accuses him of stealing. Of course, he didn't. But she's always trying to find a way to get him out of the house. Until later, she cannot do without him in the house. So yeah, it is a wonderful. It was a time when no one it's still we couldn't use the bathroom at gas stations. We couldn't use the freedoms of black. Well, I don't need to get into the civil rights and all that. We all know that those stories, but it was still a very tenuous time for black men in America. And Hulk getting on in age, he has to find a job. He's got grandbabies. He does not want to stop living, just as Daisy does not want to stop living. And that's the friendship that they and the bond that they find with each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then it's not just past; it's also present because we've got the driving while black, walking while black, just being a black man in America is still kind of risky.
Exactly.
For you, wearing the gender and the persona, so there's a current resonance. Maybe that's another reason why this particular play is a classic. Because I know that's one of the things that African American Shakespeare Company in your mission
both
classics, not just Shakespeare, but other classics have been. More contemporary classics. Let's talk a little bit about that mission, and also this is the opening of your season. What else do you have in store for us?
Well, thank you for reminding me. We have, there's a Driving Miss Daisy, which I will play Hoke. We open tomorrow, runs until November 17th. Then we have the Bay Area Classic Christmas, which is Cinderella, which I will direct this year. And I've added six songs. We've written six original songs by Angel Burgess, who's a dear friend of mine and singer in the Bay Area. So we will have a musical Cinderella this year. I'm taking a big chance with that, and I think it's going to be wonderful. We already started rehearsals. The songs are beautiful. I'm very excited about getting this cast together for Cinderella. Brand new Cinderella, of course, brand new Prince Charming. It's going to be delightful, so hopefully you'll get a chance to come through and see it, Wanda. Then we have Euripides' Medea, which is one of my favorite Greek classic plays, directed by Dawn Monique Williams, a terrific, inspiring, up-and-coming Bay Area female director. She is wonderful, and I think the Bay Area will be thrilled with her work. Medea will star Leontine Umbele Mbong, who was my Ruth in Raisin in the Sun. She was also Mistress Ford in Merry Wives of Windsor. So she will be joining the cast and playing Medea. Then I will direct Much Ado About Nothing, which will be in the spring. Much Ado About Nothing will be set 1946, right after World War II. Soldiers are coming back from the war. The country's elated. Girlfriends and wives and mothers and fathers are getting their sons back. It's a wonderful time, and I'm going to celebrate the music of Ella Fitzgerald. Ella Fitzgerald's music will permeate the entire show. All the scene changes, pre-show. I love Ella, so I'm bringing all my loves into that show. My love of Shakespeare, my love of comedy, and my love and admiration of our American icon, our own American classic, Ella Fitzgerald. And that will close out our 19th season.
How wonderful. That's
going to be a thrill.
Phenomenal. Yes. Is this the 19th year for the theater?
Our 19th season, that's correct. A 19th season of bringing classics of color to the Bay Area. Sherry Young started the company. She came out of ACT. She's our executive director. She came out of ACT some years ago and said, you know what, I need to do theater. I'm not getting cast in the types of shows. She studied theater at ACT, and she says, I'm not getting cast in the types of shows that I think I should be cast in. So she started the African American Shakespeare Company, and it's been kind of under the radar for a few years, but she's kept with it for a very, very long time. And a little under 4 years ago, she asked me to be artistic director, and I couldn't resist. This is exactly the kind of mission that I appreciate as an actor. My training, as you said earlier, thank you, was the Juilliard School. I went to Performing Arts High School. I studied at NYU. I studied in London. I studied in Japan. I've done Broadway, off-Broadway, worked in over 15, 20 regional theaters across the country. And when she tapped me for this, I realized this is exactly what I need to do. I love doing the classics. I've done over 25, 26 Shakespeare plays, directed a whole bunch. I've been in. I know all the classic plays, not all of them, but that's been my background, doing classics around the country. So this is a terrific place for me to be, telling American stories with African American actors of color. We just did last season "Cat on the Hot Tin Roof" with a completely black cast. It was one of the most successful productions at African American Shakespeare Company. And this is to see African American actors, and certainly actors of color, saying these incredibly brilliant words by these iconic writers. To see us do Medea, the classic Greek plays. The first play I did here was Iphigenia, Iphigenia, depending on how you pronounce it. I want to do a Greek play every 2-3 years. I love the Greeks. So it celebrates the African-American culture. It celebrates the African-American talent in the Bay Area. And it also celebrates the possibilities. I mean, at one time someone told Alvin Ailey that African-Americans cannot do ballet. He said, oh, yeah? Watch this. So it's all part of our culture. It's all part of our mission. It's all part of our message.
Certainly. Wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it just sounds like this is the place to hang out with.
this is the place to be, yeah. And with Lorraine Hansberry Theater, we are hoping that Lorraine Hansberry Theater will gather itself, regather, reform, and reestablish itself in the Bay Area. We all feel that there's enough of an audience, there's enough of the plays out there. But right now with Lorraine Hansberry Theater still looking for its space, looking for its footing since the passing of Stanley and Quentin, Stephen Anthony Jones has taken the helm and is keeping that theater, vibrant, keeping it alive. But while Lorraine Hansberry is still looking for its footing, African American Shakespeare Company has taken the lead, has taken the helm a little bit, we want to keep it vibrant. These plays, these actors coming out of the conservatories, coming out of these acting programs, they need a place to go and stay here in the Bay Area. So having a young actress come out of, Denver Center, as we did with ZZ Moore, to play Maggie, one of the most coveted roles in American theater, and she was brilliant. She was absolutely wonderful. But to have her come out of the conservatory, come back home where she was raised in Berkeley, come home and play Maggie in San Francisco. Wonderful. It was absolutely wonderful to have these actors come home, come out of conservatory, stay in the Bay Area a little while longer, play lead roles in these plays, and then get their footing, get their confidence to go out to other theaters. Or stay in the Bay Area, work at ACT, Berkeley Rep, San Jose Stage, San Jose Rep, and do their thing. Theater Works, who are doing wonderful stuff down in the South Bay, staying out here and doing the work, but coming through African American Shakespeare first, getting their footing, playing lead roles, leading a cast, getting their confidence, then going out in the world. And we've done that, and we continue to do that, and it's a wonderful mission that I'm very proud of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly you should be proud of it, and we're really happy that, that you're here in the San Francisco Bay Area, because you could be elsewhere.
Thank you.
Choice that you're making.
Yeah. Thank you, Wanda. That's sweet. Yeah, thank you. I'm very happy, very, very happy to be here. My son was born here. He's now at University of Chicago, doing
he
very,
is.
Very well.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm very, very proud of him. Very, very proud. Yeah. He's doing very well. And actually, he's doing some theater, which is exciting. He's doing some theater. He's acting and doing a little bit of directing as well. So the proverbial apple, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, certainly, certainly. Yeah, you have a wonderful son.
Thank you.
Well, let our audience know how they can get tickets for this current run of Driving Miss Daisy at African American Shakespeare Company, opening tomorrow evening at the Burial Clay Theater, which is a part of the African American Art and Culture Complex.
Mm-hmm.
762 Fulton Street in San Francisco,
Mm-hmm. 762 Fulton Street, San Francisco, right on the corner of Webster and Fulton in San Francisco. The box office, you can get brown paper tickets. The website is www.brownpapertickets.com, www.brownpapertickets.com, all one word, brown paper tickets. Oh, the phone number is 1-800-838-3006, 1-800-838-3006, and the ticket prices are fabulous. The $25 to $50. It's a very affordable ticket prices. Single tickets are $12.50 opening night is $25 to $50. Single tickets are $12.50 to $37. So very, very affordable to see these incredible American classics. And again, the theater address is 762 Fulton Street, San Francisco. Complimentary parking is right on site. You don't have to look for parking. There's a huge parking lot right next to the complex. So parking is a breeze. And again, Brown Paper Tickets is www.brownpapertickets.com, 1-800-838-3006, 1-800-838-3006. And we run now through November 17th, weekends, Saturday and Sunday.
Okay, cool, super. Well, thank you again for joining us, Peter. You're always so generous with your time, particularly the day before.
Thank you, Wanda.
Wonderful.
And I just said Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Actually, the only Friday performance is November 8th.
Okay.
But we perform Saturday and Sunday. Saturday at 8, Sunday at 3.
Okay.
So come on through, everybody. Come check us out.
All right. You take good care and have a great opening night.
Thank you, Wanda. See you at the theater. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye. So we are joined in the studio by curator of the Dia de los Muertos exhibit, which is an institution in the South of Market area in San Francisco. So we have Renee Yanez.
Hello.
Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Fine, thank you.
Great. Congratulations on the 14th annual Day of the Dead exhibit. And this year, Imagining Time, Gathering Memory, Dia de los Muertos 2013. And it's been really great talking to the artists over the past few weeks. Before the exhibit opened in October, and now it's getting ready to close November 9th, so people have a week to get on over there. And we're also joined by two of my favorite artists, Candy Vilas and Patricia Montgomery, and a new artist I don't know, Rashida James Sadia. Welcome to the studio.
Good morning.
So I was thinking, Renee, since I don't think I've ever had you on the show before, and this is so exciting, I wonder if you could talk to us a little bit about this year's dedication to Jose Montoya and the altar that I believe you and your son created, Spain Rodriguez and Carlos Villa, and those lives who've been affected by cancer specifically, and your life, which has also been impacted by cancer and the tightening of the sort of the rein around San Francisco insofar as pushing people out who have been really integral to the fabric of the San Francisco Bay Area, San Francisco, the city. I mean, what is San Francisco without you there, right? And your work.
Well, that's, to me, it's about the work too. And this year, I'm very, very proud of the exhibit. It has harmony and balance, and it, I think, takes people on a journey. And with has a new artist like Rashida that's doing an altar to Trayvon Martin that I see it have an impact. And also Adrián Arias has a large hoodie. It's also having an impact. So I'm proud of this artist. C.J. Grossman is also doing something on Bullicide about teens being driven to suicide by social media. We have one in Syria that has children's drawings from the refugee camps. So I'm very proud of this year, and it's the kind of work that my son and I do. My son has a 3D display. I have the Alter de José Montoya from the Royal Chicano Air Force. So it's really trying to put this across to people in the audience and how important it is. And Patricia, it's also has a very beautiful piece. Odin, it talks about cancer and the environment. She projects cancer cells. Miranda Bergman has a large painting. So all of these things come together to me, a reason. And, you know, it's, but it is unfortunate that these evictions, mass evictions, are happening in the Mission. There's part of the procession. People are meeting at 6 o'clock, November 2nd, Saturday, on 24th and York. And it's going to be a procession about the evictions. So people are also gathering to be part of the procession, but with a message. So people are mobilizing, and I see a resistance because, as you well know, the things, tragedies that happen in the city. I remember the Fillmore when it was a very much lively place. It had Minnie's Can Do, and it was jazz and blues, and redevelopment came and took the soul right out of the Fillmore. And I see the developers and real estate people with greed taking the soul out of the Mission.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So talk to us a little bit. How's your health? And then talk to us about your altar.
Well, my health, you know, I'm hanging in. I go to the Veterans Hospital and getting treatment. The eviction has been very stressful, though. It hasn't helped. So, on that situation, and my altar is dedicated to José Montoya, compadre of mine. He passed away also from cancer. He was a general in the Royal Chicano Air Force. It was an army of artists, musicians, poets, muralists, silk screen, T-shirts, posters, and anything. And they were very instrumental in the UFW movement. They did a lot of posters for Cesar Chavez and the boycotts. So, and he was a great poet and musician. You know, I really miss him a lot. I have done work with his son Richard in Culture Clash. So, I have a display of some of his drawings and some collages that I did on his behalf that I've done throughout the years. I just put them up. But I, you know, really miss Jose. And so it's a whole question about cancer, you know, where it comes from and how sometimes in communities how it develops. So it asks a lot of questions because when I go to the doctor, they can't tell me where it comes from.
Oh, huh. Wow, interesting. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to read a little bit from a bio that I found on you. It's an old one, but I think it's, you know, it says that Rene Yanez is an artist, curator, and producer who lives in San Francisco, a founder and former artistic director of Galleria de la Raza. Yanez was one of the first curators to introduce the contemporary concept of Mexico's Day of the Dead to the United States with Rooms for the Dead and Labyrinth for the Dead at the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. Since the early 1970s, Rene Yanez has been instrumental in establishing the Day of the Dead as an important cultural celebration. With co-director Ralph, co-director of, I believe, the Galleria,
Ralph Mara,
the celebrations were marked by increasingly large exhibitions, ceremonies, processions, and school-based activities. They quickly spread beyond the Mission District, encompassing various communities in the Bay Area, California, the American Southwest, and back home to Mexico. Active as both a visual and performance artist, curator, and artist, Yanez co-founded the successful Chicano performance trio Culture Clash, which you you mentioned. Yanez is widely recognized for his innovative art projects that promote a greater awareness of our culturally diverse society. He has curated numerous exhibitions, including the art exhibit Chicano Visions, American Painters on the Verge. The collection features work by Chicano artists from around the United States. And during his 5-year, 15-stop tour, Chicano Visions was shown simultaneously with his companion cultural site, Chicano Now, American Expressions. Throughout his decades of work in the arts, Rene Yanez has remained a stalwart supporter of grassroots organizations and community artists, collaborating with organizations such as SOMARTS, you know, where you have your Dia de los Muertos for the past 14 years, Open Museum of California, which also has a Dia de los Muertos pattern after yours, Yerba Buena Center for the Arts, Kearney Street Workshop, Mission Cultural Center, and the San Francisco Arts Commission. You've been a strong role model and a vital cultural force in San Francisco arts community. So I just thought that was such a nice bio, and I didn't even read it all. So welcome, Rene.
Well, you know, it's the kind of work that I do that, because I've been accosted by people saying, well, you know, like, you're an artist, get a real job, or this kind of situation, and you wouldn't find yourself in this situation if you were to open up a commercial gallery instead of Galería La Raza. But, you know, it's sometimes not about the money. And things like Day of the Dead, these things, cultural manifestations that I work with and put together, is very conscious from the placement, the artist, the message. And, you know, you can't do it on a commercial bent. So, you know, I invite people to come down to the exhibit at SOMARTS 934 Brennan, and I'm going to be there today. I'm going to be there Saturday. I'm going to be there Sunday. Sunday we're open 11 to 3, so please come by. I would love to see people, and it's been very well attended, but I'd like to see more people come by and see the exhibit. We have short surveys to ask people what's their favorite piece. We really want to know. I'm really learning a lot, trying to communicate with the audience, because all these things are important to me. You know, if I wanted to make money, I'd be there selling T-shirts or posters. But to me, that's not what it's about. It's about creating community and working with artists that are professional. Some of them are non-professional, but they're working together, and it balances it out into a spiritual, ritualistic exhibit that has something to say. So, you know, you're welcome to come by, and you were so kind to read my bio, but I work really hard as an artist, because when I do workshops and I work with young people, to me, all that, it's important, you know. So it's, you know, it to me, it's about the work. So, you know, I don't know if I could say anything more.
Right. I just want to mention again that the Somars Culture Center at 934 Brannan Street between 8th and 9th has, you know, the exhibit is free during gallery hours. And, again, Renee mentioned that he's going to be there today. And actually, the gallery is open Tuesday through Friday from 12 to 7 p.m., so 12 noon to 7 p.m., you know, for most of the week. And then on Saturday from 11 to 5 and then Sunday from 11 to 3. So it's, you know, there are a lot of opportunities to get by and see the exhibit, because most often you want to go back because it's just so phenomenal. And if you missed opening night, which was the 11th of last month, there's a closing reception Saturday, next Saturday the 9th from 6 to 9 p.m., and that'll be a wonderful opportunity to see the exhibit again, because you're going to go this weekend, and because this weekend is real special. It is actually the Days of the Dead this weekend. I mean,
yes.
What is it, November 1st, November 2nd?
Yeah, November 2nd. And I also, if people want to come and join the procession at 24th and York, wear black, bring a picture of a loved one, and join people that are resisting and protesting this unregulated redevelopment. You know, supervisors like London Bree has weakened the rent control laws to the point that there's mass evictions. So we're asking people to come in solidarity and participate. We're asking people no alcohol in this procession, and to come with pictures and wear black.
Okay, cool.
Okay?
Yeah, sounds excellent. And Patricia, we've had you on lots of times. You are just one of our favorite artists, Patricia Montgomery, African-American textile artist. And you can tell us about what you've created for this year's...
Wanda?
Yes.
Could I be excused?
Yep.
I have school children waiting for me at at Somars. I have to give some tours. We have so many school children coming through that I told Deborah Bach that I would go help her. But thank you so much for having me on, and say hello to Patricia and Rashida. And I want to thank them profusely for their participation. You know, again, I urge people to come and see this great artist.
Right, yeah.
Okay.
And show up tomorrow for the procession. Well, thank you, Renee, for joining
thank
us.
Thank you so
and,
much.
Yeah, take care.
Oh. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Patricia.
Hi, Wanda. How are you this morning?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well.
So tell us about your exhibit this year. Yes.
My piece is titled African American Dressmaker Memorial, and it's a dress that symbolizes the spirit and honors the memory of African American dressmakers who have been designing dresses and had their own dressmaking business since the 1700s. And many of them are very unknown. And this idea came across when I watched the movie Lincoln, and Mary Todd Lincoln's dressmaker was African American. And in fact, I've just finished doing a quilt to honor her. And so some of the people that I mentioned within the pattern pieces of this dress are like Zelda Valdez, who designed a hip-hiking style that most known as the mermaid dresses. And she designed them for like Dorothy Dandridge and Josephine Baker. She was also commissioned by Hugh Hefner to design the Playboy bunny costumes, or Ann Lowe, who actually created Jackie Bouvier's wedding dress when she married Senator John F. Kennedy. So it is a piece that honors these women, and it is a corset. I created a corset, and the bottom of the dress holds pattern pieces with all their names and the story about them, and the back wall is all done with pattern pieces, sewing pattern pieces.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really beautiful. The dress is in real pretty different sort of blues, and as you mentioned, you know, on the backdrop of the altar, of the installation, you know, there are, you know, these tissues, you know, with the various patterns in a collage on top of one another. It's really wonderful about this particular Dia de los Muertos exhibition is that, you know, there are installations, so you could actually, each one is self-contained, and you could actually step into it and just meditate on it to the exclusion of the others, because everything, it's sort of, it's almost a room within itself, like you can step into it, and the way you have this particular dress hanging is almost as if you could imagine yourself in the dress, or imagine people in the dress. You could actually, you know, see the spirits evoked literally through this particular, the way you have it displayed and hung. Was that intentional?
Yes, it was. I've always played with the concept about having pieces to be interactive with my viewer, and this piece does that because it is in the center of the room and it's hung with like fish line, and it also when people pass it and everything, it creates its own movement. So you're right, it does act very much like it's the spirit of all of these women that were great, and they contribute so much to the fashion industry, and many people do not even know them. And when I started researching them, I really felt really blessed and fortunate, because we have something in our history that goes back so far, you know, making dresses and making your clothing and knitting and sewing, and it's not, you know, by accident that I've ended up being a textile artist, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. and over the years, which exhibit is this for you?
This one, I think, this is my ninth exhibit. I've been in a part of Day of the Dead since Renee was at the Mission Culture Center. He gave me my first opportunity to create an installation piece, and I will to this day never ever forget that whole experience. And he is right; it is all about the community and doing the art and working with the artists. And in the olden days, it was so much that friends I've developed and met as artists through In Day of the Dead, we're like, we come back together every year just so that we are together. So it is very much that kind of community and family and art. And it's really more than just art, you know. It really is. It becomes so much a part of who you are and how you can contribute and do something that's a little bit different. And I really appreciate Renee for that type of an opportunity for artists. And at the time, I was so young and so new to all of it. I mean, he gave me my opportunity, and I'm very, very grateful to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're going to come back to you, Patricia. I want to give Rashida, who's been so patient, an opportunity to join the conversation. Welcome, Rashida. And I was looking at your wonderful piece, and I wonder if you could tell our audience sort of what the different aspects are of it, because it's really sort of multi, you know, media with regards to the assemblage of it. You've got cowrie shells. It looks like one of the Indabele dolls, the shape of it. And then you've got these, look like a halo in the back part of, or wings even, in the back part of the figure. So I wonder if you could maybe describe for the figure, because you, what do you title this particular work?
My piece is entitled Remembrance, and it's an African-centered altar honoring the physical and spiritual existence of Trayvon Martin and his mother, Sabrina Fulton. So I think during the process of sort of learning more about his murder and the trial and the decision for this elongated trial, I was constantly bombarded with negative images and articles and comments that sort of removed the human element, I felt, and removed the concept that this was a young man who was capable of adding so much to the world, but was sort of being reduced or labeled as a thug. And so I sort of wanted to create something that reminded us that this was someone's child, and that this was a human being and this was a part of our community at large, and this person was removed. And so I was inspired by two different elements of African culture. I was inspired by the stools that are made in Ghana, primarily of the Akan people, and I was inspired by the Ndebele dolls of South Africa. And so you're right about the doll. And so the stools are typically carved when a child is born, and the wishes, hopes, and dreams of the community and the parents are sort of like engraved in the pattern of this stool, with hope that these things become an element of this child that they will add to the world and add to the community. And so I thought it would be really interesting to kind of take that concept and use a contemporary Americanized toddler chair. And the chair for me represents Trayvon's stool. It also sort of represents the concept of him being here and now not being here, because your stool in this cultural understanding is that once you pass away, it's pushed against the wall or it's turned on its side, and people who visit your home leave well wishes and gifts and affirmations. And so I wanted to try to create a space where people could just leave something like kind, you know, and kind of have like a space to just remember him. And so on the chair, there's a picture of Trayvon when he graduated from kindergarten. And I just felt like that was the perfect picture to just sort of like remind us of the tragedy and also sort of the complexity of adults burying children and how this is happening so very frequently across the U.S. and just kind of give people a place to interact with their feelings and fears and confusion. And so the doll also represents for me Trayvon's mother, because the doll is typically used and passed down generation to generation with stories and advice, and it's also used for women who hope to get pregnant. And so I thought that this would be sort of like a beautiful protector and guard of his spirit that was once here and his spirit that has entered the other world. And so the doll stands in front of a bowl that collects these well wishes from those who interact with the piece. And she is the carrier, taking them back to Trayvon.
Oh, nice, nice. So... and then you have an Dinkra symbol on the card, which has a heart on one side and a Dinkra symbol on the other side. And you've got these feathers, look like peacock feathers or a guinea hen feather. They're feathers. Well, you can talk about the feathers. And then I think you have a container filled with looks like jelly beans, but I'm not certain. They're colored beans. Look like they could be food, could be stones, I don't know what they are. And then you've got a cylindrical piece, and then you've got these cards, and you've got this fabric that is sort of running underneath the chair a little bit and under the doll, under the bowl. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so maybe tell us about some of the other elements of the work.
So the jar is actually filled with Skittles.
Oh, it's Skittles. Okay.
Yes.
yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so I wanted to sort of, I think there was an element, I also use children's blocks to spell out his name, because one of my concerns was that possibly people would not recognize that this was Trayvon, because this picture of him at such a young age was not really something that we were bombarded with. And I also wanted to add the Skittles. You know, there's a connection to that with his murder, obviously, but also sort of this thing that one could maybe assume that he liked. And so sort of like placing this at his altar. The fabric is handmade and dyed. And so these colors for me, my family, is Igbo, and so these colors that are used, the blacks, the whites, and the brown for us, represent the earth and the sort of concept of returning to this place in which you came from. The feathers for me, my son actually took a picture, which is used in the altar. He found a beautiful feather on the ground, and later he added a quote about sort of the living being, the carriers of those who are dead, and that those who are dead are not dead. They are existing and breathing and living in the memory of the living. And so I thought that was a beautiful quote, and feathers for me sort of like represent rebirth and potential and magical things and also sort of like this beauty for me in terms of using death not only as something that's like final and permanent, but also this thing that should be celebrated. And using it on the doll for me also kind of created an effect of his mother's spirit being able to sort of like hover over him and protect him in a way that possibly she was not able to protect him in this space of the living.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the cowrie shells?
So there are lots of cowrie shells and glass beads that are used. There's also a cinnamon that is used, and these are things for me culturally that are used in ritual and prayer and remembering our ancestors. I'm also just sort of like remembering the journey of like birth, life, and the celebration of death. And so I wanted this piece not to, it's a very like challenging and complex and in many ways like serious subject. But I also wanted there to be small pieces within this that represented celebration and honoring the beauty and the positivity of this person's life and remembering also the family in which he came from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't know if you answered the question about the Indian Chris Dumbo, the one that that reappears in the work.
The Adinkra symbol, for some is sort of defined as except for God. And I think for me, as I mentioned before, I felt as if the aspect of humanity was very much ripped from Trayvon. In many cases, his family was sort of forced to protect his image, protect his character, to, you know, use language that sort of, like, gave his life worth. This wasn't something that was sort of, like, instantly given to him as a human being. And so that symbol for me in the context of this exhibit sort of removes the ability of, I guess, of human beings to define who you are. And the capabilities of your spirit, that this is something that is defined by a higher entity. And also reconnecting that this person is an element of beauty and an element of love and a reflection of God and how easily that's removed from us in situations like this.
Yeah, and that happens when, when we're at war. The first thing the person consciously or unconsciously does is dehumanize the person in front of them that they have to kill, because if they see the person as a human being, it's not as easy to kill them. So as a society, to take this child and render him inhuman makes his death all that more palatable, and acceptable. Tragic, but acceptable, because this wasn't a human being in the first place. So, the altar is so multidimensional. It's really wonderful. It seems like a lot of thought went into the work, and all of the elements are restorative, as well as celebrating his life. It's really, really wonderful. Has his mother have you been able to send this to her? Because you include within it a healing as well.
Yes, I was able to send a picture of the altar to her, which for me was a very healing experience as well. my son is 14 years old, and I think after the verdict, I remember sort of being in this place where I sort of feel like I'm very active in my community, but going through this process of sort of feeling as if I wasn't doing enough, and also that I needed a space to vent and share as a woman who has a brown child, and like, what does that mean? And what are sort of some of the fears surrounding that? And so creating this piece for me was also very healing, and I was able to sort of, like, I think get out of a lot of confusion. And it was a beautiful experience to use my son's photography in this piece. And so I felt that I wasn't just honoring Trayvon Martin, but unfortunately so many other young men who've been killed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And then more recently, you know, the young man who was killed in Solano County.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Ah, wow, really, really beautiful. So, Patricia, wanted to ask you if you could maybe reflect on the importance of in your life and in your work of remembering our ancestors and in the various, the work that you do as, you know, as a textile artist, known really well for your beautiful story quilts. I mean, oh my gosh, and the quilts that of people that you've taught how to do these this work. I mean, because you're literally similar to Rashida's work, you know, where she's incorporating aspects of the person. I mean, when you quilt, you're actually taking tangible pieces of the life and putting it together in a way that honors them, you know, physically. And then after the quilt, you know, has served its use, then, you know, like actually sleeping under a quilt or having a quilt hanging, that the pieces are embody that personhood, you know, the tangible personhood that's no longer with us in that way. That's a really phenomenal type of work that you do, and I'm sure it makes those, I mean, it sort of brings the people, the ancestors, closer. And it also, if it was a personal ancestor, probably is a way of comforting the family and the friends and the loved ones that are left in this particular form, you know, once they make their transition.
Well, I think a lot of times when I create my quilts and I do about, especially the story quilts, I find that that in sewing them, and it's a very odd thing, in sewing them, you start to really experience who that person is and what they were about and everything. And the quilt kind of like starts to talk to you. And so you kind of, you know that you're on the right track, using the right colors and threads and so forth. But also, too, it gives an opportunity, because I find sometimes certain subjects are hard for people to talk about. In case in point, I did a quilt about slavery, and it's a beautiful quilt. And but because of its beauty and everything, it created dialogue. People were able to all of a sudden walk up to it and really see what was happening and really begin to talk about it. So there's that aspect. And then there's the other aspect of just acknowledging people that have been here before us and leaving a lesson behind. I think more this particular piece is more about not only honoring these particular dressmakers, but allowing other people to know who they are. You know, a lot of times we don't know these people. And I have another opportunity in the future where I'm going to be honoring women from the civil rights movement that are unknown to us, but they were great contributors to the civil rights movement. So in that way, we not only honor their being and what they did for us, but we also allow the generation under us to learn about them. And I think that's a really important tidbit that ends up being put out there that we're unaware of. And yes, it is very interesting when you sleep under a quilt that you've made specifically for a different reason, and then you sleep under it, it does become very comforting and warming, and it connects you to the spirit of those individuals. And we can't forget them. We really, really cannot forget them. We have to be aware of making sure our generations under us know who they were and who they are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just thinking about No Name Woman, which is a story from Woman Warrior, wonderful novel written by Maxine Hunt Kingston. And in No Name Woman, the story, which is an excerpt from that particular novel, the woman, her ghost just wanders because she has not allowed to be named in her family because of something that she did, which brought shame on the family. So she's wandering, not being able to find a home after she's gone because no one would call her name. And I'm thinking about, you know, these dressmakers whose work you honor in the symbolic dress, and then, you know, the work that you say you're working on presently, the women who we don't know that are part of the civil rights movement, and how, you know, spirit is tangible. And so when you call their names, there's a certain satisfaction that happens.
Yes, it is. And it was amazing because I can remember at the opening when I was explaining my piece and talking about it and how I would name these women and I would tell the story about them or around them. And people were very surprised, you know, and I found that it was very rewarding to give them presents. Even now, you know, that's like the 1700, but to give them presents, to let them know, yeah, I really do. I'm very grateful you are here because through you, somehow, I learned to sew.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Yeah, Rashida.
Yes.
Sort of reflecting on, you know, remembering ancestors, and you talked a lot about that when you were telling us about, you know, this wonderful installation. You were talking, you know, sort of culturally, you were talking about the fabric and the colors, and yeah, it sounds like this is a practice, you know, that is ongoing in your family.
Yes, very much so. For me, the use of African material or African art in general, the focus is that it should be functional. And so it kind of has like this dual functionality of being very much, you know, spiritual and holding intense meaning, but also being something that's like very functional in your household. It isn't necessarily made to be something that is just looked at, but explored and passed down and sort of like used to send guidance and send messages. And so I think it's very important when able in any form of art to remember your ancestors, to remember your culture, and to sort of like use that vehicle, leave room for people to, you know, sort of develop their own understanding and ideas, but, you know, try to offer some element of what you consider to be important wisdom that you've learned from your ancestors or from your culture, just even immediately from your parents, just sort of the beauty of being able to pass things down. And I think art serves like a really beautiful tool in being able to do that in a very silent way. There's a lot of thought, you know, that goes through the artist's mind in terms of like creating, but like once it's finished, and the beauty or questions or complexity that people will take from that is really amazing. You know, I think this exhibit gave us a really beautiful opportunity to sort of like be there and like talk to people and explain what we were thinking, but most importantly, to hear what they're thinking and what our piece is sort of like inspired within them and what kind of questions they had. And so I think that's just like a really beautiful and sincere way to be open and honest and to learn new things and to explore, but most importantly, to share with one another.
Yeah. I was thinking about when you talked about functional and how, you know, traditionally African art is functional. You wear your art. You are your art. And I was thinking about Alice Walker's story, Everyday Use, and specifically, Patricia, in this particular story, the matriarch of the family, the young woman who goes off to college, her mother makes quilts. But the girl, she doesn't quite understand sort of the functionality of the art. And it's a really, really interesting story. Are you familiar with that story, Everyday Use?
I'm not familiar with that story, but I do understand the difference of when you're giving something to someone else. I think when I'm teaching quilting, one of the things I do is I really stress the importance of really become the art. Let the art come through you. Don't put away all the rules and regulations and all the rules about having a straight line, et cetera, because when you become that art and you give it to someone else or even share it and seeing it with someone else, they experience what you were putting into it. There's a story about how in African-American quilting, women would put a symbol or a sign or something very special into the quilt. No one knew it was there, but it was there so that the spirits would be able to travel throughout the quilt itself and not just on a straight line. And that's what you give when you do textiles. And textiles are, people gravitate to them a lot easier, but that's a really wonderful story, and I have to make sure I read it now.
Yeah, I'll look for it. I'm sure I probably can find a link to it. I'll send it to you. I think you really like it, because what happens is the girl, she sort of comes full circle in appreciating the art and her mother, whom she's ashamed of. She goes away to college, and then she's ashamed of her country, rural rearing, particularly her mother, who I don't know is, you know, she's not, I mean, she can read and write, but she's not fancy. And and so she's kind of ashamed of her mother until I think she brings a boyfriend or someone who's interested in her back, and he just becomes really fascinated over the art, you know, the textiles. And then she sort of sees her mother in another light. Still, you know, sort of the character is evolving. But it's a really wonderful story, as Alice Walker is always so phenomenal in her work. Really
yes,
love,
she
love
is.
Her work, her art, her activism, and her life has just been one evolving story of engagement in community, which is really fascinating. Wanted to allow both of you to share with our audiences how they can be in touch with you. I noticed, Rashida, you've got voyagesjournal.com. Voyages sounds like you're moving.
Well, there has been months of moving. Voyages Journal is definitely how it can be reached, so voyagesjournal.com. And it's basically a hub for literature, art, and dialogue surrounding the African diaspora. And it's something that my husband and I created 2 years ago. We're both in academic programs, so we're currently in the Bay Area for school, and soon we'll be relocating to Senegal for research.
Oh, wow, nice. Oh, so where are you at?
At Berkeley.
Okay. In the Diaspora's studies program?
We're actually both doing cultural doctorate programs in cultural anthropology.
Okay. Oh, nice. Yeah, so I'm looking at your Voyages Journal, that's nice. Wow, so you're going to be, Senegal is where my family, my adopted family is, and Rufus, any particular part of Senegal?
Beautiful. Well, we'll be in the city, and we also will be traveling throughout various villages in the country, so we're doing multi-site work, and the research is surrounding a Muslim community that is in Monk's Corner, South Carolina. I'm the leader of this community is from Senegal, but it's a very diverse community. Although the majority is African-American, it's a very diverse community. And this particular community they are sending their young children to Senegal at like age 4 to study Islam, to learn French and Wolof, and to come back and be leaders in their community. This community also has women who are considered sheikhs, so sort of like a sheikh in the Islamic community. And so there are a lot of beautiful things there, and it's also very close to the Gullah Islands, and so sort of combining the history of that island and like sort of the things that are being created there now, and going back to Senegal to sort of trace how this community came to be.
Yeah, I met a professor who's at a university in Canada, and he traces his family's he has a Muslim name that the family didn't take on the name, the family had the name, and he can trace his Islamic tradition back to the continent. And he also is, I'm not sure if he's Gullah or Geechee. I'm not certain which one, but it's been a long time since I've called his name, so I can't remember it. But do you know who I'm speaking of? He's really a famous scholar. And I think
I'm
he was in Toronto. I'm not certain, but I can get his information for you.
That would be great. Sure. Thank you.
Yeah, because sounds like he's someone that you might want to talk to.
Yeah, we're really excited.
Oh, super! I definitely want you to stay in touch.
Yes, I will.
Okay,
I definitely will. Thank you.
Yeah. And will you be at the closing reception? Just people who weren't able to catch you at the opening?
I will.
Okay.
I will be there.
Super. Excellent, Rashida. And Patricia, Dragon Art Place. How mysterious and fun. tell us about your the name of your website and what's there.
Dragon Art Place is, Dragon is my Asian astrology sign. So when I designed the site, I wanted to connect to the energy of the dragon. And when you see the dragon on my site, it's a golden one with a pearl. So it's about fortune and good luck and everything, so, and prosperity. So my site, hopefully, in the future, is going to actually bring that all to me. So a lot of the work on my site consists of my installations, and especially some of the pieces I've done for Day of the Dead, a lot of my various textiles and everything. And hopefully, in the future, I will have an e-commerce store where I will be selling quilted, tablet covers, all abstract in nature and designed and thread paintings. So I'm looking forward to getting that off the ground as well.
Oh, that's wonderful. And I want to let our audience know that Patricia Montgomery is the famous artist whose work graces covers the frescoes, the permanent frescoes in the African American Museum and Library of Oakland. And it's right there. They're right there on 14th Street at Martin Luther King Jr. Way. And so when you walk into the building upstairs and you look up, you see these beautiful art panels. And Patricia collaborated with a visual artist. Could you tell us a little bit about that really quickly? Because I don't remember the name. Yeah.
The artist I worked with was Daniel Galvez, and the quilt that is designed throughout the piece is the quilt that I created to use, and I'm very excited to really say that this year I won the Creative Work Fund grant to do a project with AMLO, in collaboration with AMLO, the African American Museum and Library in Oakland, and I will be creating a 20-story quilts that will be designed into swing coats to simulate a civil rights march of the African-American women that we don't know that were a part of that movement. So this grant will allow me to be able to create this new work. And as we all know, Creative Work Fund is a very competitive grant, and I got it this year, so I'm pretty excited about the whole process.
Congratulations. How wonderful. Wow, wow. So will you be at the closing reception as well for those that are
yeah.
able to meet you?
Yeah.
Okay. Excellent.
Yeah, I'm always there. I enjoy interacting with the public. When I can remember when I first started being an artist and having to do shows and interact with the public, I was very shy. But now I really do enjoy it because I enjoy hearing what they have to say and their reactions to it, because that's what art's really all about in a lot of ways.
Wow. I want to thank both of you, Patricia and Rashida, so much for joining me today to talk about, you know, your work as part of the Dia de los Muertos exhibit at SOMART's Imagining Time, Gathering Memory, which is the 14th annual Day of the Dead. And hopefully, Rashida, this is not the last one for you, that we'll be seeing you again and again and again and again.
Thank you. I hope so as well.
That would be really lovely, and definitely interested in you know, your research in Senegal. Sounds really fascinating, and congratulations, Patricia. My goodness, 20 story quilt. I can't imagine 20 stories.
Yeah,
like,
so exciting.
That's really big.
Yeah. I kind of like, I'm still wondering what I was thinking about. But
yeah,
I have
really
a year to create the project, and so I think it's going to be really wonderful. And and the whole concept of them being coats and being hung in the space to allow people to interact with them and walk through them, so they will get the sense of feeling what it's like to be in a civil rights march.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's the Elihu Harris and Barbara Lee lecture series this year, which is, I think it's next week, actually. I'm not certain the date. They are actually going to be having four women, daughters of civil rights activists, speaking.
Oh,
so,
wow.
Yeah, so I'll send you a link to that information, because you might
that will
be
great.
Want to be in the house for that. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's going to be
definitely.
Yeah, you know how they have the series, which is at the Marriott in Oakland,
mm-hmm.
and it's
yep.
free. It's collaboration with the Martin Luther King Jr. Center, but this one here is going to be really special because, like I said, it's looking at the offspring of these civil rights activists and they're with us presently, so we can see sort of what. Kennedy's daughter is doing, and what Reverend Abernathy's daughter is doing, and so it should be kind of interesting, because you don't think about it. Well, they did actually have families. We just think they belong to us, and they didn't have a life outside of that.
No, they had one. We just don't hear about it all the time.
Exactly.
And thank you, Wanda, so very much for having me on.
Oh, you're welcome. It's been really, really lovely. And again, Rashida, it's been my pleasure, and look forward to meeting you.
I look forward to meeting you as well. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. You take good care.
You too.
You too.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye. Peace and blessings. So we're going to close the show with Ademo Majun, Isu Exit, and you're going to be able to see Ademo. He is actually performing in the Lower Bottom Players current production of the August Wilson Century Place cycle, and they're doing Fences, and that's going to also be performed at the African American Museum and Library later on this month. So here's Ademo Majun, Wolf Hawk Jagger, and Isu Exit.
I'm We move in harmony.